This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the great pleasure of talking to Craig Johnson. He's the author of a number of novels, all mystery novels, that are around a character called Walt Longmire. I'm really pleased to talk to you.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I guess, you know, I should, you know, for people who don't know, who might be listening, you can go to his website and I will... I'll give Craig Johnson's email address, I'm sorry, website address as part of the write-up for this. I'm not going to give away your email, but...
Thank you, I appreciate that.
But there are eight novels in this series around the character Walt Longmire, who is a sheriff in Absaroka County, Wyoming. And, you know, it's now, I mean, these books have been going for a number of years, and you now have a A&E television show called Longmire based on your novels. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the first book, which is The Cold Dish, which I thought, I got to tell you, was one of the best mysteries I can remember reading in a really long time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Incredibly complicated and well plotted. And, you know, I'm not like some people are, you know, they only read mysteries or they only read science fiction. So they become more knowledgeable than anybody on earth about their specialty.
Right.
And I'm a generalist. I read a lot of different things, but
so am I. I have to agree.
I thought it was terrific. And
well, thank you.
Incredibly amazing that even though I was beginning to figure out something was going on at the end, it took me a really long time to figure out where it was going, and I really like that about a mystery.
Well, I gotta admit that one of the things that worried me the most, you know, about writing in this specific genre was that, you know, I really didn't know that much about it. I mean, to be quite honest with you, majority of the stuff that I read is literary fiction, you know, a lot of nonfiction, you know, biography, those type of things. The one genre that I read the least amount of was probably crime fiction, was probably mystery novels, and so I was a little worried about, you know, being in that particular genre. And one of the things I did, I have to admit, is that whenever I started, you know, thinking about writing the book The Cold Dish, it became very apparent to me that the one thing that I didn't know is that I didn't know a lot about sheriffing, which is a very specific style of law enforcement. I mean, it's the only law enforcement official, it's the only policeman that's also a politician. He's the only one that has to go out there and also get votes. But the thing I really liked about that was that the character would be connected to the community and to the society that he served. It seemed to me that that was something that might be a little bit different from a lot of the stuff that's, you know, that's out there now, where these lone wolf kind of characters kill 27 people, you know, by the time that a book is over with, and really don't have any connection, you know, with the society and with the culture and all of that. And so I thought, well, what I need to do is I need to go and, you know, utilize those most, you know, seductive words in the English language. Tell me a little about yourself. And so I drove in, you know, the 20 miles into the county seat here in Johnson County, Wyoming, and spoke with a man by the name of Larry Kirkpatrick, who'd been the sheriff here for a couple dozen years. And so I learned a lot in a very short period of time about, you know, what it was he did and how he did what he did. And one of the things that was also beneficial to the whole progress of the novel was that he tried to guess after every chapter who it was that did it. And I have to admit that he guessed all the way through until chapter 15, you know, when it's kind of revealed who it is that did it. And he never did figure out who it was. And that gave me a lot more confidence in what I was writing. I also informed him that it gave me a lot less confidence in the homicide investigation abilities of Johnson County Sheriff's Department. But, you know, thank goodness he didn't take that personally, and continues to read my books to this day.
Well, you know, I was actually, you answered one of my questions, which is great, which is, you know, how did you get to, you know, this character and this kind of, you know, I like the idea that, and I agree with you that, you know, what you've done is, the solver of the crime was not a detective in this case, but, or in your books, but is the sheriff, is he's not a, a superhuman, he may be above average in intelligence, which I think he is, but, and he's kind of like you. I mean, he's read, although you never really talk about, you don't talk about what he's reading, but it's pretty obvious that he reads, because he's got some, you know, he's capable of quoting liberally from books.
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the initial, you know, responses that I had to the book. When I wrote the first two chapters of The Cold Dish, one of the first things I noticed was that I really didn't enjoy my protagonist's company. And you know, when you're writing in present tense, you know, that's kind of a dangerous situation to be in. And so I started thinking, well, you know what? He needs to be smarter. He needs to be more well-read. He needs to be funnier. He needs to be more insightful, all of those things. And so once I finally started thinking about, you know, the kind of guy that I wanted to hang out with, you know, in his head for 400 pages, you know, Walt kind of, you know, came together for me at that point in time. So it's been handy like that, because I think that's probably the strong suit of the series is that character, Walt Longmire. He's not what you might expect, which I think people enjoy.
Well, no, he is tremendously heroic. I mean, in the sense that he is a literary figure, he's heroic in the way that heroes operate in all fiction, I think, or in, you know, in mythology, that he is intrepid. You know, he won't quit. I mean, I thought that was one of the characteristics that really made him special, was that there was no way he was ever going to quit.
No, you're absolutely right. I thought of all of the gifts that I could give him, the ability to, and not only in a physical sense, because he does some, you know, some pretty amazingly, you know, amazing physical things during the course of the novels, but he's also one of those guys that would just knock on one more door, that would make one more phone call, would go through a crime report just one more time. And, you know, it seemed to me that those were the kind of guys that, you know, that broke the cases. Those were the guys that had, you know, the resources to be able to continue on when everybody else would say, you know what, I really just don't care anymore. In a lot of ways, I tend to refer to him as kind of a detective for the disenfranchised, because he kind of tends to take on cases that maybe the rest of society doesn't really care about. I mean, in the first book, The Cold Dish, you know, it's basically about a young woman with fetal alcohol syndrome who's, you know, taken into a basement. She's Northern Cheyenne, and she's taken into a basement and taken advantage of by these four high school football students who happen to be white in this adjacent county to the reservation. And after they do that, they basically get off with suspended sentences, and then somebody starts killing each one of them with a Sharps, you know, buffalo rifle, a .45-70 Sharps buffalo rifle. And, you know, a lot of people in the community, their attitude might be, you know what, you know, justice be served, you know, it's just as well. You know, but with Walt, there really isn't any sliding scale of justice. You know, a crime is a crime, and, you know, there are laws, and there are rules, and there are courts, and, you know, vigilante justice is just not something that he's going to, you know, be able to tolerate. And I think that that's, you know, that intrepid part that you were discussing there earlier, too.
Well, of course, it makes him a kind of classic, you know, cowboy hero, too.
That, oh, absolutely. You know, he's kind of the, you know, like one of those white hat kind of guys. He's
right.
You know, he's a direct embodiment of that, you know, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, cowboy code, you know, kind of character. And to me, you know, that makes him, you know, very reassuring, I have to admit. I mean, it's a much more complex world, you know, that he has to deal with, you know, than perhaps, you know, a lot of those characters, a lot of those, you know, fictional characters had to deal with in the past, you know, but that just makes for more, you know, intriguing situations, you know, and more complex situations for him to find himself in.
Well, it also humanizes him, so that, you know, here's where I kind of was going with the, you know, the idea of the hero is that sometimes the hero stands away from everyone else. And of course, we want the hero to be identifiable with our own abilities and we want that hero to do something that is better than we are and that can do something more than we can, and he does. And you don't simplify it, and I thought that was good. You know, I appreciated that he was living in a complex world. He's realistically he's a character who you could meet. I mean, he may be exceptional, but there are exceptional people. And you know, if the fact that he is also understanding of and connected to Cheyenne and Crow and Sioux people, not just, you know, not just sort of imaginary people, but actual people. And, you know, I know that's a big part of your, of the novels, that, you know, there's this the interplay between two different cultures, you know, the American Indians living in Wyoming and Montana today.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you did, you know, I thought that was, you know, you've made some really memorable characters there.
that's kind of easy to do, you know, where I am. I have to admit that most people, whenever they ask me, where do you get your ideas for, you know, for all these eccentric characters, I'm always thinking to myself, you don't live in Wyoming. If you did, you really wouldn't ask me that question. But then the other aspect of that also is, you know, the people that I know up on the reservations. I mean, where, you know, my ranch is located at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, right there on the Wyoming-Montana border. We're basically surrounded, you know, by these sovereign nations, these reservations. We've got the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow to the north. I've got the Shoshone and the Arapaho to the southwest. I've got the Lakota, you know, to the east. I mean, we're basically surrounded by these incredible, incredible people. And, you know, one of the dirty little secrets about my books is that, you know, I feel a lot more comfortable writing about Indians. And I do say Indians, I don't say Native Americans, simply because all of my Indian friends make fun of me when I'm trying to be politically correct. They always look at me and say, "So where were you born?" And I say, "Well, I was born in America." "So you would be a Native American too then, wouldn't you?" You have to be much more careful about, you know, making sure that you get the tribal designations correct, and you have to worry about being politically correct. But, you know, they're just amazing people, you know, with these amazing backgrounds, and I tend to utilize people that I know as characters in my books. I mean, there was this great quote that's at the beginning of Wallace Stegner's on, you know, writing and teaching fiction, where he says the biggest, you know, piece of fiction ever written is that disclaimer at the beginning of every book that says no one in this book is based off of anyone alive or dead. You know, what a crock. I mean, that's your job, is to go out and find those people that are going to be able to tell the story that you want to tell in your book. And it's a little tough in Wyoming, where there are only 500,000 people. I mean, we're the ninth largest state, you know, in America, but we have only 500,000 people in the whole state. Well, it's even worse up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, because there are only 5,000 enrolled members of the Northern Cheyenne tribe. And so I tend to utilize, you know, real people from up on the res. I can go through the listing of all the characters in my books and tell you that, you know, that Henry Standing Bear is based off of Marcus Red Thunder, probably the best friend I've got. That Lonnie Little Bird is based off of Charles Little Old Man. I can go down through the list and just name every single equivalency, you know, of every characters in my book. And to me, what that does is it kind of keeps me really well grounded. And it also, you know, another aspect is that I tend to take the ideas for my novels from newspaper articles. Like that, I'll, you know, take out newspaper articles from some of the small newspapers. You know, they're little weekly newspapers that only come out once a week, you know, in these little towns along the High Plains. And, you know, I what it does is that kind of keeps me from, you know, ever, you know, being tempted to put Walt on a cruise ship, you know, or Walt on a, you know, a skateboard or something like that. I mean, it keeps Walt grounded, you know, in the problems and the difficulties that, you know, that face, you know, the High Plains towns and the reservation too. And so that, you know, to me keeps the books kind of believable, and I think that's important.
Oh, I think it is. Well, and of course, the only place where I think we have to, you know, do the willing suspension of disbelief is that there would be so many complicated cases like this that would face a single sheriff in a territory like yours. Although maybe I'm wrong about that. You know, would that exact, you know, how many murders are there in your county in a given year? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, there really aren't that many. And I think it's actually, I think it's in the second book, you know, where Henry looks over at Walt and says, "How many murders did we have in the last 22 years?" And Walt says, three or four. Like, how many have we had
right
in the last 6 months? And he says, about three or four. And he says, "I think you should retire." So, I think what happened is I kind of stumbled into Walt's world and started making his life a little bit more complicated. But,
right. Well, you know, but we, I think any reader knows that, you know, that, you know, this is fiction, you know.
I mean, I'm dying to write a book that's called No Mystery, like that, where, you know, Walt keeps stumbling onto potential crimes that never seem to pan out. But, you know, I think everybody would probably be a little bit disappointed in the genre if I were to try and actually attempt that. So,
although you might have, you'd have to figure out a really, really funny way for it to tie it all up, you know, that it could be, maybe it's, you know, avoiding the idea that it's a hallucination or something.
Right,
like that.
Right. You hit on another note there as far as the books are concerned. I mean, that's another thing that I think is a very strong aspect of the books, at least I hope it is the humor that's in the books. I mean, you know, so many of, you know, crime fiction writers, I read their stuff, and the problem that I have is they're just so devoid of humor. There isn't any humor in their books at all. And, you know, I just, you know, to me, anybody that's ever had a difficult job, anybody that's ever, you know, had to do something that they really didn't like doing on a day-to-day basis, the only way that you get through those kind of days is by having some kind of a sense of humor. And, you know, one of the things I've discovered is that cop humor is very similar to cowboy humor, which was once explained to me by an old rancher by saying, "You want to know about cowboy humor? Everything's funny till you're dead." And then he paused for a second and he goes, you know what? Dead's funny too sometimes. Like it, and so it kind of gives you that kind of indication that I think that, you know, is I think one of the strong suits of the books, I hope, you know, whenever people read them, that they sense the humor that's there. Not comedy, but humor.
Definitely humor, and it's the kind of humor that people have when they're faced with difficulty. It's a, you know, it is, I know, Indian humor is very dry.
Oh, and, yes, very much.
And also the pacing, as you actually talk about it, I think in one of the books, I can't remember which one now, but there's a place where the telling of the joke is part of the humor. you know, the way the joke is told. And I thought, you know, you can't, I mean, clearly, you know, the people that you're talking about, and that I think comes through. And, but you also do this with a lot of love, and that's important. Otherwise, you know, people would be caricatures and you would be, you know, you wouldn't be true to their, to who they are as people.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, that demands, you know, one of the demands that a place makes of you, you know, if you are writing about a place and a people that you love and a place that you love, look, that the only thing that they demand of you is that you be honest. I think you have to show, you know, the multi, you know, dimensions that are, you know, inherent in a complex people like the Northern Cheyenne or the Crow, or, you know, the people that live in this small town, you know, on the high plains. Like, I mean, all of these people, you know, they have the same wants and desires and, you know, fears, you know, as a lot of people have. And I think probably the guy that said that best was probably John Steinbeck. I think it was in one of his acceptance speeches, maybe for the Nobel Prize for Literature. Like, he actually said that, you know, in good literature, what you're attempting is you're attempting to try and find a universality in the human condition. You're looking to try and find something, you know, that we all have in common. I mean, there's so many things nowadays, political parties and groups and all these kind of things that are trying to convince us, you know, that we're so different and we have nothing in common and all this. And that's just crap, you know, because we do have so much in common. And I think one of the things you're responsible for when you write is to try and find that empathetic, you know, aspect of the character that will make the reader feel like, you know, I know this person. I understand this person. I am, you know, in some ways this person. But to me, that's the highest flattery, you know, that you can possibly obtain as far as a writer.
Well, no, actually, you made a really interesting point there, and I think it's the idea that that fiction allows you to sympathize with another person.
Absolutely.
And that is really a powerful thing to understand, that fiction makes you, in that way, you can actually say that fiction might make you a better person.
Oh, absolutely. It bridges those gaps, you know, those gaps that you have, you know, between peoples. And so, you know, I think that that's one of the things, you know, when these people are reading about, you know, characters, you know, that are sitting there in Lame Deer, you know, Montana, at a cafe, you know, these Northern Cheyenne peoples, like that, they really shouldn't be that alien to them. They really shouldn't be that different to them. They may be like that, but they're going to be touchstones, you know, within the elements of their character and their emotions and, you know, their intellect that I think people are really going to be able to connect to. And, you know, to me, it's kind of a challenge in the sense that, you know, there are few enough ethnicities, you know, in the high plains as it is, like that, you know, to leave the Indians out of my books that take place in the contemporary American West would be, for lack of a better term, and no pun intended, criminal. It really wouldn't be right.
No, I agree. Well, there are a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, too, about, you know, the place where you are and in your kind of your story. Did you grow up in Montana? I mean, in Wyoming?
I was born in West Virginia, like that. But my father worked for AT&T, and so we moved around an awful lot of the country. And I had grandparents up in Montana, and I had grandparents down in New Mexico. So generally, whenever anybody would ask me where I grew up, I'd just say I-25, you know, because I just, you know, had all that pretty much memorized. But it was my grandfather was a blacksmith, you know, and so, you know, I actually rodeo cowboyed, you know, ranched, you know, when I was younger, like that, I didn't ranch like that, but I worked as a cowboy on a lot of ranches throughout, you know, the Northwest. And I, you know, delivered horses down to U-Cross, which is actually where my ranch is. I built my ranch. I poured the concrete, stacked the logs, you know, built the barns, the shops, and the corral, the fences, everything. Did it all myself, you know, because my grandfather had done that, my father had done that. And it was kind of a challenge and something I always wanted to do. And so, you know, I think I was in my early 20s when I delivered horses down here to U-Cross, and I just really liked the area. And I thought, if I ever get the chance and the money and everything all kind of falls together, this might be the place where I want to build my ranch. And so I guess it was about 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, I bought the property and then recovered from that financially enough to actually build a little 24 by 36 foot log cabin. And so I built that cabin, and I've been adding on to it ever since. As my father says, you didn't know it was a life sentence, did you?
Well, that's sort of, you're working in the tradition, I think, of people who went before you. You know, for the most part, when people landed in a place like where you are now, historically, they would build, you know, a small place as quickly as possible to get it in before winter came. And then years would go by, and you could see the old house, and then there's the add-on and the add-on and the add-on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, and I've got a wife who's from Connecticut. Like, so I had to get the windows and doors in and get the heat on out here. Like, so there just wasn't any two ways about that.
Well, you know, it actually in Connecticut, where when the early settlers came here, the same thing happened. They would build these small houses, and then if you look at them over the next couple of hundred years, the house would get added on to, and the same thing happened. You know, you can sort of excavate the archaeology of their lives.
Oh, absolutely. So, with that footprint of their home, yeah.
Well, what did you do before you started writing these novels? Because obviously you, maybe you did just, develop full bloom as a writer. You must have been working at this for a while.
You know, I did a lot of different things. I kind of did that Jack Kerouac, journey of, you know, self-exploration. Like, I mean, there was a lot of the world out there that I wanted to see, a lot of things I wanted to do. And so I traveled around a great deal, you know, just, you know, going a lot of different places and learning about a lot of different things, doing a lot of different jobs. I had this basic idea that at some point in time, you know, I wanted to be a writer. I came from a family of readers. You know, our idea of hell was to be stuck somewhere without a book. You know, that would be the most horrific thing that could ever possibly happen. And so even to this day, you know, I've got books sliding around on the dash of my truck. I've got them stuffed in the side pocket, door pocket, center console. And I'm probably the only rancher I know who has a bookshelf, you know, in his tack shed on the barn so that when he's waiting for the horse trough to fill up, you know, he's got something to read, you know, so that the time isn't lost there. And so, you know, and a couple of my degrees were actually, you know, in creative writing, but, you know, I really didn't solidify an idea as to what kind of writing I wanted to do and what it is that I wanted to write about until I was kind of in my 40s. And then, or in my mid-40s, like, I actually had this, you know, breakthrough that I think an awful lot of authors have. It's pretty simple. Basically, you run out of excuses is what happens. You know, I got the first part of the ranch built. I got things all kind of up and going. And I was sitting there in the office here at the ranch, and the thought, you know, kind of came to me that, hey, you've always wanted to write a novel, and that's kind of what your education is in. You know, maybe you should actually sit down and attempt to write this novel. And so I started out writing this novel about this sheriff in the least populated county in the least populated state in America, and that was the cold dish. And I was fortunate enough that it got picked up by Viking Penguin, and here, I guess, about a year and a half ago, A&E and Warner Brothers got interested, and so he's kind of on billboards and the sides of buses and on banners that are flying up and down the beaches, you know, across the United States. I got to tell you, I haven't seen any of that here in Ucross, but they tell me it's happening, so I guess I must believe it happens.
Oh, it's definitely true. If you go into New York City, you will see Longmire on, you know, on telephone booths or on bus stops. So
we don't have any buses or telephone booths here in Ucross, so I guess I have to cut them a little bit of slack.
I know. Which I wonder if does anybody ever put billboards on the side of cows?
It would be a different kind of sandwich board. I think that might make the cows nervous. I don't know.
Well, they might not notice. So if you, you know, do one of those things, you know, they do this thing now where you can put a wrap on a truck or a car where it's that, you know, it goes on it. They don't even know, you know, you're driving around as a billboard. So you could probably do it. Of course, the problem is that the you know, you pay by the impression, essentially. You know, there's not enough eyeballs out there to make it worthwhile.
I don't hardly think, no. The population of the little town that's the nearest to my ranch has a population of 25. So it really wouldn't be worth it, I'm afraid.
So do you find, as a writer, I mean, this is sort of an interesting question because many writers are solitary. Obviously, you write by yourself. You know, it's you and the paper. You and the piece of paper in front of you or the computer screen, whatever you write on. But, you know, writers like to have kind of socially active literary lives sometimes. And I, in your case, I would imagine you may be one of the only writers for many, many miles. So, I mean, is it something you even think about, or do you seek out the company of other writers at any point, or you just go on about your business?
You know, I guess I probably am the go along about your business, you know, kind of type. Like that, I tend to like the isolation and the focus, you know, that living, you know, in a very, you know, far flung region, you know, kind of gives me. I mean, for me, it's much more important to have a balance between the intellectual and the physical world. And you know, anybody that owns a ranch or a farm knows, you know, just how much outdoor work, you know, is involved. And so, I kind of have a balance, you know, between those two, which you know makes for a pretty good lifestyle. And then, I guess I get enough interaction with enough other writers, you know, from all of the book festivals and the tours, the library events and all of the things that I go out and do. I mean, when I actually sit down and try and figure it out, I think I kind of figured out that I spend about 4 months out of the year out and on the road, you know, doing different events and involved with other literary involvements and that type of thing. And that seems to be plenty enough, I have to admit.
So, and is your ranch a working ranch, or is it, do you raise cattle, or what do you do?
We used to have, you know, we used to be, you know, more of a cow-calf operation like that, but then when the books took off, you know, I was gone so much that it was very difficult to continue doing that. And so, what it is now, it's just horses is all it is. So, and the horses are pretty good. They're actually probably the best literary friends that I've got. I mean, generally they know what kind of a mood I'm in before I, you know, head down to the barn. And then when I get there, I can discuss, you know, the books with them, you know, and they listen very intently and do not burden me with any kind of advice on what it is that I should do as far as the books are concerned. So, but they're actually a pretty good, you know, board of directors, actually, when you get right down to it.
Well, I think your horses, I think, are animals that quite a few writers have related to. I don't think you're alone there.
Oh, no, no. It's like Churchill said, you know, the outside of a horse is always good for the inside of a man. So.
I think you actually use that quote in one of the books.
Yes, I do. Like, and they actually used it on the television show, too.
I heard that. I heard it recently. I think I can't remember which show it was, but I just saw it the other day. And well, the other thing, you're in the books, there's quite a bit of, let's call it firearm lore. You know, guns play a pretty active role. Obviously, they're part of what kills people. But I noticed that, I mean, this great character in the books, Omar, who's, mm-hmm. you know, he's the closest thing I think you have to a kind of 20th century super spy kind of character. You know, he's this mysterious guy. He's got tons of money. He's a guide, you know, a big game hunter guide, but he's so rich. And he's able to buy almost anything he wants. And he comes along. He's a pretty handy guy to have there. You know, he supplies a helicopter in one case. And
he does.
You know, but he also knows more about guns than anybody else. So is this something you also are familiar with, or did you have to go out and learn this stuff?
You know, I basically grew up in a household, you know, with a familiarity, you know, with weapons, and you know, my father was a gunsmith, and so, you know, I learned an awful lot of this simply, you know, by osmosis, like that. But then the other dirty little secret is I've got a fellow by the name of Richard Rhodes, who lives about 10 miles down the road and has a great big huge ranch down there, and you know, he was the model, you know, for Omar, to be quite honest with you, and so. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that I was trying to show, you know, within the context of, you know, the Cold Dish and the entire series, is there really is a dichotomy in the American West, you know, that you know, it's been there for quite a while and it's doing nothing but getting worse as far as the haves and the have-nots. I mean, there are going to be the people that live, you know, in house trailers, you know, and, you know, have to go break up truck skids, you know, to have enough wood, you know, to be able to keep warm in the winter. And then there are these gigantic, you know, McMansions, you know, that these people have built, you know, these log mansions, you know, for people that live in Wyoming maybe, you know, 3 months out of the year, if they're lucky, maybe 6 weeks out of the year. So, you know, that was one of the important parts of the book, you know, to try and get across. But, you know, once again, you know, a lot of this stuff is just, you know, the people that I know. The more we're going to go on with this conversation, you know, the more you're going to come to the conclusion that I'm really not that good of a writer. I just know a lot of interesting people is what it is here.
Well, that's part of what makes a good writer, though, is knowing that you know those interesting people and actually remembering and kind of understanding who they are and able to, incorporate them into your writing. And, the other thing that I thought was really important was that Longmire has this kind of ongoing struggle in himself where there, and I love the, I think it starts with the Cold Dish where, in, you know, this incredibly heroic time when he saves Henry as well as this young kid, one of the guys who had been wounded, one of the kids you were talking about who had raped the Indian woman. And he does this thing kind of, he has a significantly spiritual experience with the the Cheyenne, the old Cheyenne as you call him, and that runs through the books. I mean, I think that that doesn't, that's a big part of who he is, and that in it you have other occasions where, where that the other one that I thought was a really powerful book, and of course I haven't read, again, I haven't read them all, but Hell is Empty, which clearly is modeled on Dante's Inferno, but you've got this amazing character Shade, who really this guy is living in that other universe on a daily basis, and he talks to Longmire, and of course he doesn't get, Longmire just won't play the game. He won't participate in that kind of, this is real, I am going to live here way that people sometimes do. He just, he obstinately stays in the old-fashioned cowboy mode. Doesn't ever, he never makes fun of the spiritual, but he doesn't really let on either that this is going on.
Well, I knew that there was going to be, a resonance of spirituality, if you will, within the books. There was going to have to be something that was going to, maybe, catapult us, into, another level. And, whenever, I think about where it is that I live, the way I describe it is that, my kind of people have only been here for a couple of hundred years, but my friend Marcus Red Thunder, his people have been here for thousands. And so it's quite possible that they might know a little bit more about what's going on around us in this area than my type of people do. And I have to admit that I've been to more sweat lodges in the last 20 years than I have actual churches. So for me, when I thought about that, the resonance of that spirituality, I knew that that was going to be, it was going to be Indian. It was not going to be white. And I think it's an important aspect that continues to reverberate, through each and every one of the books.
Well, though you have Longmire do the sweat lodge with taking peyote.
I do. And I can either confirm or deny that I may have ever, partaken of any kind of instance where that may have happened to me, like I
I
said,
was
huh?
not even going to ask you. I was just going to assume this was a case where you just learned it by osmosis. but no, I thought that, I think that's, I agree with you. I think it's really important to include that. And it's also, I was thinking, what is it that really grabs people about these books? And I wonder, what have people told you who have become big fans of Longmire and of you, of course?
A lot of it, it seems to stem from the characters. It always seems to stem from the characters. They really enjoy the people that populate these books. Like that, they find them to be, different. They find them to be interesting. They find them to be humorous. But I think over and over again, what's happened is that the characters are what it is that's, kind of pulled the series along. One instance of that, was that, whenever, there was a young woman who was an agent from CAA, like that, which is the big one of the big artistic associations and agencies out in Los Angeles, and they do, producers and directors and movie, movie stars and all that type of thing, and they actually went to my literary agent's office in New York. And the agent went in there and she said, I'm looking for books, with really strong characters. She didn't say I'm looking for, a Western. She didn't say I'm looking for a mystery. She said, I'm just looking for books with really strong characters that we can develop into television shows and to movies. And, God bless my agent, Gail Hawkman. She reaches behind her and pulls a copy of The Cold Dish out of the shelf behind her and tosses onto the desk and says, that one. And the young woman from CAA, she says, well, are there any others you want to give me? And my agent says, no, not until you read that one. And I'm not going to be changing agents anytime soon, I can tell you. Like that. But it's kind of indicative, I think, that one of the strong suits, of the series is the characters. If you, if the series is going to succeed, it's going to succeed on the shoulders of Walt Longmire, of Henry Standing Bear, of Victoria Moretti, the transplanted Philadelphia patrolman, like that, who becomes the undersheriff, for Absaroka County, the Basques, the Indians. I mean, everybody that's involved, in this community, kind of makes up the strong suit of what I think the series is.
So does, and just one other question about characters, does Katie, his daughter, does she, she's, is she going to be back living there? Because, earlier on she's away.
Right. And I can't give away too much like that, but there are portions where she does come back. And and it'll be interesting to see exactly how that plays out. I mean, because he's got this daughter who is this lawyer in Philadelphia, and it's kind of one of the sadnesses in his life that they have this kind of removed relationship. You were talking about the faults in Walt's character. One of the things I've always heard is that you like people for their virtues, but you love them for their faults. And Walt's got a lot of faults. Like he's what I tend to refer to as over. He's over age. He's overweight. He's overly depressed. I mean, he's got a lot of things working against him, but he still tries to go out there and do the job, which I think is one of those things that is very important for him. That intrepid quality you were discussing before, and one of those intrepid aspects of his life is that relationship with his daughter. And that's something that's obviously in transition and will continue to be in transition.
Well, so just before we finish, maybe can you say what it will be the name of the next book, or is
I
it?
can, I actually can. The next one actually will be out next year. It's actually called A Serpent's Tooth, and it's from Lear's line to Cordelia, and it's an ungrateful child. It's not
Ah,
quite
yes,
like
right.
a serpent's tooth. And so it's actually about a polygamy group that moves into the southern portion of Absaroka County and the difficulties it produces for Walt.
Well, it's a book I'll be looking forward to reading. I still have a ways to go. I haven't read all eight, but I'm working my way through pretty rapidly because, like, whenever it happens that you find a book, a series that you like, and I think most people respond this way, you just want to keep reading. So, I got to compliment you on that. You've written a book that, or a series of books that I should probably hate you for because they're taking me away from my work and keeping me up at night and
You know what? Reading time is never lost time, though. That's a good thing, I think.
No, I
So.
agree. But I take it away from sleep a lot. So, you got to be careful. But I've enjoyed these books tremendously. I've liked the show. I think the show is terrific. But you got to read the books.
Thank you, sir.
Well, my pleasure. And thank you again. Thanks for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Craig Johnson. His website address is Craig Allen, Allen Johnson.com. And I highly recommend taking a look at the site, which is a lot of fun, and going out and starting to read the books.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Craig.